a lot of people do not have any respect for any other people in this world. So you just got to cover your own self and have conversations. And if they align with you, then they align with you. If not, then step away.
You're absolutely right, and I'm sorry that happened to you. Wow. So you were with a female who was secretly recording the two of you having sex?
Mm-hmm.
Did you...
You know, and to be honest, with me, it didn't bother me. It didn't have an impact on me, so to say, but it was one of those, like, well, not the best idea, but okay, you know, we'll play along, see where this goes, but I can understand where it bothered this individual.
Yes. Gilbert, I'm sorry, but I hear them playing my theme music to sign off. Thank you for the call. Call in again sometime, please.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And Portland Pollies, I will see you all, or talk to you all again the day before Thanksgiving, the fourth Wednesday of this month. Until then, happy playing. Talk to you then. Bye-bye.
No, I think I smile and stay to see where this might go.
Oh, it's the last time I was falling in love.
Falling in love
and feeling I'd never fall in love again.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Well, we've reached the second Wednesday of the month at 11 o'clock. It's time for the Dirt Bag. Good morning. This is Glenn Andreessen, and we're not in the studio today. Once again, we're having to record this ahead of time, but just a few days, so we're pretty current there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Glenn. Nice to see you. I understand you've just did some really amazing traveling. So
yeah, we're back on this side of the world.
And it's a pretty nice side of the world right now. The sun is shining and we've had some rain and the roof fruit is ripening and I'm pretty happy here.
Of course, this is all being made possible because our buddy Joe Wilson of Bergman Productions is facilitating this recording and he's the one that makes this happen. Jim, if he didn't have Joe, I don't know, these last 5 years we would have been... I don't know what we would have done.
I don't know either. We'd have to. Technology is, of course, the very miraculous thing too. It allows us to do this. But yeah. Joe is definitely an essential part of the program. And
he sure is.
Joe.
Yeah. And Joe is—he's with. Are you in Boise? Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And Jim is. They're in the Liberal.
I'm in Liberal.
Yep. Yeah. And I'm here in Portland.
And in Portland. Yep. Yeah.
So we have a full show, as usual, and just to give you a rundown here, we have our plant of the month, and it could go from, heck, we've got plenty of things to talk about, but persimmon is one of the things that we'll be talking about today there. Also, Jim wants to talk about making cider. Love it.
Yep.
And I don't know. We'll have hear what he has to say on that. Also, I'm not going to go through my there must be 50 ways to love your leaves. I'm not going to talk about all those. I do that about every 5 years or so. But anyway, I will make the point that we do need to. This is a wonderful opportunity to get a free resource. And it does so much good in the garden to use leaves, especially if you haven't been able to plant a cover crop. Oh, do that. At half past the hour, we have a garden stumper. Then at, let's see, curing olives. Yes. Following up on our talk about olives last month. And also winterizing tools. If you have those, don't leave them out in the rain. That's the worst thing we can do. And also, I think this is a pretty good time. I mean, you could wait any time for the next month or two anyway to divide rhubarb and other plants that are now dormant. This is the time to think about that. Our Dirtbag Dictionary term will be cold frame. Pretty simple, but a wonderful way to extend your season. And I don't even know if we'll have time, but we'll see if we get a documentary update there, since we have Joe in here too. Also, finally here, what I'm trying to understand this month, and this is just me personally, but I find it interesting that when the military or a country will say, if there was an incursion into somebody's airspace, that they scrambled their jets. I just wonder where that word scrambled comes from. You know, is there a better term? You know, everybody knows what it means now. Just kind of curious how that name came about. Like you scramble eggs, not jets.
But, well, maybe they all take off in different directions or something.
Well, they only have one or two runways, I guess.
Yeah, I have no idea, but obviously.
It's probably online someplace.
Yes, I'm sure.
But then I couldn't talk about it. Okay, well, anyway, Jim, what tool have you used mostly in the last month?
Good question, Glenn. You know, I've been doing some traveling and some other things too, and so my tool use has been pretty minimal. Mainly, it's mm-hmm. been a knife to cut open fruit that we're evaluating and sampling. So you would not believe our office right now. It's full of feijoa or pineapple guava fruit. Today, my partner Lorraine and I have been eating pineapple guavas just one after the other, sampling them to see if we can find the best one ever. But it's kind of fun. But a knife is the tool.
Do you swallow the fruit that you taste, or do you spit it out?
It depends on how hungry I am. Generally speaking, it's not bad. I mean, I could tell some stories. Some years ago, we had a bunch of Brazilian seedlings. We were in Brazil. I cleaned some seed there, brought it home. We planted it, and that was one of those things that I was very, very surprised. It was like, do I have to eat another?
Oh.
Or taste another? They were terrible, but the ones we're doing now are from much better seed lots, and they're not. None of them are like that. They're no spitters. They're just tart ones sometimes, I generally eat some, and I'm generally hungry to enjoy it.
Well, I want to explore this for just a little bit more. So if you get a bitter one, then does that just end the trial right there for that one?
Yep.
And so you have to keep very good records.
Yep, and that's Lorraine's job. She has a notepad and a map of where all the plants are in the field, and she makes notes on each plant whether it's acceptable or not. And it goes, there's like the next stage. So if it passes the first test, then we put a question mark by it. If it doesn't, it gets an X, and the compost pile gets bigger.
What happens if it does pass the first test, then what's the next test?
Well, then we give it another year for a second harvest.
Okay.
And we'll test it again next year. And then it'll, the whole idea, this whole idea of breeding is a sad goal in a sense of reducing a large number of plants to very, very few. and ultimately perhaps two or three that have everything, the best characteristics of them all. It is quite amazing, really, how much you have to do. I was just reading a story about New Zealand apricot breeding, and there's a longer story, which I'll share someday with the listeners, but the short story was that they were searching for new varieties, and they had 15,000 seedlings that they were sampling.
Wow.
That's a lot. I mean, we might be doing 1,000, which is really a lot too, but I mean, that's that 15,000? Wow.
Is it just you and Lorraine that are doing the tasting?
In this case, yes, because we're sort of the most experienced with this particular fruit. But I also have to admit that I sometimes wonder if I'm doing it exactly the way I should be. I don't consider myself a professional. We've done it some, and we know kind of what we're looking for. But sometimes you think, gee, you know, maybe that one should be passed or not. But generally speaking, I think we're doing okay.
Right. Okay. Well, I haven't really been using any tools. I mean, I've been gone for more than 3 weeks. So in the interim, I just haven't been out in the garden. But it will be the rake soon, or pitchfork. Anyway, getting the leaves up and off the street and into the beds where I want them to go. So
yeah,
that'll be this week.
I think my next tool is going to be the battery powered chainsaw again, because part of what I was just talking about, a lot of plants have to be removed.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's been a little while since we've talked about persimmon. I think that's our plant of the month.
Yes. Persimmon is an amazing plant to me. I'm very, very bullish on persimmon right now, and I can't hardly talk too much about how enjoyable it is as a plant to grow. I mean, it has several really positive characteristics, and one in particular in our climate is the lack of any disease or pest problems. So you can plant a persimmon tree and pretty much not have to do anything, you know, maybe some pruning later on as it gets older. The biggest thing you have to do is pick the fruit. And so what our goal with persimmons has been over the years is finding ones that do well in our climate, because it's not pest or disease problems, it's ripening time. So we need to make sure that they will ripen within our particular season. When I first was starting the nursery, I remember driving over the Newburgh area, and I was on a side road, went around a corner, and here were three persimmon trees. They were tall ones. They were probably 20 feet tall, covered with, and it was in the fall, and the leaves had fallen, and there was this bright orange fruit. It was like kind of an interesting Christmas tree with orange ornaments. And I was just like struck by how beautiful they were. And that's what I really enjoy this time of year, is the persimmons now are losing their leaves, and in the process they also have a beautiful fall color, most of the varieties. So you not only get the fall color, but then you have these orange fruit that hang on later, and they stay on the tree until they get soft, and when the birds will come and remove them for you if you haven't done it. Another very interesting characteristic of persimmon or quality is that there are really two types, and one we now call crisp sweet, and the other we call soft sweet, and the difference being that the crisp sweet you can eat like an apple when it's firm. Typically, people will call those Fuyu types. There are two sort of main names that sort of go with those, Fuyu and Jiro. We've got some other ones that we're working on too, but basically those are kind of pretty standard ones. And the main point with those in our climate is to get early varieties. So we have one called Early Fuyu, and we have Early Jiro, and now we have one that just knocks my socks off, because it's almost a month earlier than any other one we've ever had. And we named it after a bird, which we also have named some other interesting varieties recently. So it's called Cardinal. So anybody living out in the country, like in Liberal or someplace where it's a little cooler climate, that variety is going to be a real winner because it's beautiful, bright orange, and it ripens in early October. So really good shape. The second type, which I mentioned, would be the soft sweet types. And I remember years ago being kind of like struck by the fact that if you went into a grocery store and there were persimmons on the counter, and sometimes they would be the Fuyu type, or they could be what a variety that's very popular in California called Hachia. Well, there was no signage that told you you couldn't just pick up a Hachia and bite into it when it was firm. But if you did, and I imagine there might be a listener or two out there that did that, you would find out pretty quickly that that was not the right thing to do. But wait till it gets soft. Then it's quite good. I mean, it's a really quite delicious fruit, and I really like them a lot. And so we have some new varieties of those as well. But that type of Hachia, if you go to the store and you're lucky enough to find those for sale, put them on the counter, on your windowsill or whatever, wait till they get nice and soft, and they're a joy to eat. And we also have a very interesting one of that type that we call Raven. Well, as you might imagine, Raven is black. So here we have a typically orange fruit that develops a very shiny black skin, and it's very unusual and also quite good too, and it also has to get soft before you can eat it.
What color is the fruit inside?
It's orange inside. Uh-huh, as a regular persimmon. Uh-huh. Yeah, but they're pretty fun, and as I said, they're so darn easy to grow. There's of course persimmons of somewhat of a broad name, so I should mention also that there are American persimmons, and if any of the folks are listening to the show from some place that's colder than or Western Oregon, there are some pretty interesting varieties that we've brought in over the years. Some of the names: Prairie Sun, Prairie Star, Prairie Dawn, Prairie Gem. The American persimmon fruit is smaller than the Asian persimmon fruit, and they all have to be soft before you eat them, but they're quite tasty. And these trees, varieties can grow down to minus 25 Fahrenheit. So they'll grow in much colder spots. Yeah. But that's a brief overview of persimmon.
All right. Are they all grafted?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you of course, you can grow them from seed, but the chances of getting anything worthwhile is pretty limited.
My neighbor's tree are a few houses away. I don't know if it is, but the tree is taller than their house. It's a big one.
It's an Asian persimmon?
Yeah.
Yeah. The typical Asian persimmon doesn't get super big super fast, but if it gets old, I mean, I've got some here that are probably close to 20 feet tall, but they've been out there growing for over 30 years with no pruning. So, you know, but they're pretty easy to keep small. They're not super vigorous plants. And I've got other ones that I have done some pruning on that are 8 to 10 feet and very nice trees.
Yeah.
They're a little hard to pick when they're 30 feet tall.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you, Jim. That's persimmon. Yeah. We'll leave that there for now. Okay. It's time for our first musical break. And I'm thinking of our theme for this time. And, well, you know, we've got Thanksgiving coming up here. So our musical theme is birds. Bird. Thanksgiving bird. But it doesn't, the tunes don't have anything to do with Thanksgiving, of course. First one, called Birds, is from Coldplay, of all groups, from their CD A Head Full of Dreams. Snappy little tune.
Studying the lights,
Okay, that's Coldplay. I don't know what year that album was from, A Head Full of Dreams. But we'll next move on to making cider, at least how Jim makes cider. You've got plenty of apples to choose from. Do you specifically choose cider apples?
Well, that's a really good question, Glenn. This year, I got to first say that I have never seen such a nice apple crop as this year.
Oh.
And I think a two or shows ago, I talked about the postage stamp orchard.
Yeah.
Where we were harvesting fruit off of the columnar apple trees, which were maybe 3 feet in diameter, and I was getting over 40 pounds of fruit off some of them. That adds up pretty quickly. So I'm sure I have over 400 pounds of fruit. And that's amazing. I mean, and the fruit is beautiful. And somebody asked me the other day about codling moth and said, it was my friend actually who has a commercial orchard up in Hood River. And what do you do about codling moth? And basically, when there are some fruit that have them in there, or they've been in the worm has been in the fruit, but it's of course left, and we just cut around the area where the codling moth is. But the fruit, we don't spray anything on our apples, and of course we choose varieties that are disease and resistant as best we can do. So for cider, the typical, we don't grow specific apples for cider. I know there are some that are grown that way, and I think that they generally are grown to make a hard cider because they're pretty tart fruit, as I recall.
Yeah.
But we make soft cider, so it's very nice to drink, once you've made it. And what I do, we make quite a lot. Last year or 2 years ago, I think I made 12 gallons, and I froze a bunch of it and then drank it for all the rest of the winter and spring, and it was very nice to have it. Now, I'm fortunate to be connected to Lorraine, who has a semi-pro apple press. But I've also used the more conventional types that have a screw that goes down a cylinder made out of flat kind of slats of wood. Pretty simple, basic way to do it. It's nice to have some sort of device attached to the press or nearby that will grind up the fruit. So you just toss the fruit in, and it's got spinning wheels, and you end up with a cylinder or a whatever container you're making the cider with, full of some cut ground up apples. And then you just press, of course, and the juice comes out of the apples. We experiment every year with the apples that we happen to have a lot of to see which ones we think was going to make the best blend. And some are tartar than others. But of course, the sweet ones, the juicy, and you want juicy apples as well. But it's a pretty simple process, and the end result is some very, very tasty and, I believe, nutritious juice.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds pretty easy. You've got the equipment.
Yeah. And there are people that I don't remember the name right now, but there was a local manufacturer of cider presses that used to bring them to the All About Fruit Show.
Right.
Orchard Society was doing that. And perhaps one of the listeners, I know on this show, nobody's going to be able to call in because we're not going to be there. But if they think of it, the next show or something, I would like to remember the name of that cider press maker, and perhaps we can do a little tribute to them and throw them some business if they're still doing it. But it's a very valuable tool if you like apples and you have some. And one thing I have found out about apple trees is they really want to bear fruit, and probably more than a person's going to be able to eat and even make pies out of. So making juice with them is a good thing.
Right. Well, if listeners do have questions for us, and or if you want to take a stab at the Garden Stumper, which we'll be getting to here, you can write to us, send us an email at thedirtbag@kboo.org. Okay, let's see. Before we get to the bottom of the hour, I'll just give my annual plea. It's not a plea. It's just an encouragement to get out there and use the free resource of leaves, which pound for pound, have more nutrients than even compost, but not nitrogen. No. But leaves are a great way to prevent soil compaction, to conserve moisture, keep weeds down, prevent soil compaction. There's just a lot of reasons to use leaves, and one of the best things or ways to use them, I think, is to, like I mentioned earlier, if you haven't planted a cover crop, is to put them on your vegetable beds that now or otherwise fallow. Although I still have a few tomatoes still growing out there. My plants are still, there's even blossoms on my tomato plants. I haven't had really time to explore in the garden, but I can look out there and see them now. So they're still there, but there are some beds that are open. And I will put the leaves down, and then I leave the leaves all winter and even in almost forever, because on that bed next spring I'll choose to plant, tomatoes or peppers or something that doesn't require the whole surface area to be covered with seeds or whatnot. And so I just leave the leaves, take a handful where I'll be planting, and in other words, just plant through the leaves a little bit. It's kind of the lazy way to garden. Another way to save times and add nutrients there to the bed in the meantime too. So, getting them from the street, yeah, no problem. Unless it's a real high traffic area, I don't think you need to worry about that at all. The leaves haven't been down for very long, and just get them and stash them.
Glenn, are there any leaves that you would recommend not using on a bed that you know of?
The rule of thumb is, for a walnut, for example, that they have compounds in them that will prevent things from growing. And if you have a lot of walnut leaves, then use those leaves where you don't want a lot of things growing. These compounds will prevent seeds from germinating, and that could work to your advantage. Most of the time, however, you're not going to have enough of any one kind of leaf to really make a difference. Oaks does have, they certainly have tannins, but just not enough that you're going to worry about, in my opinion and in experience there too. If you have leaves like magnolia leaves or something like that are pretty stout, you can run your lawnmower over them first or through a shredder or something like that. But even still, they will do all right breaking down. The thing is you're just going to be leaving these leaves rather than trying to process them. And so with time, they'll break down. And eventually, you won't even know they're there. They get incorporated into the soil by worms and pill bugs and other macroorganisms. And maybe next year I'll bring out my list of 50 ways to love your leaves. It just takes a little time to read through all of those, but they're kind of fun.
Sounds great.
Okay. Well, let's see. Looking at our... Yeah, I think it's time. We can go for the garden stumper. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Okay. Well, this is kind of an, I think it'll be an easy one, and I'm not sure how our listeners going to be able to respond, Glenn. Can they email us?
They can email. That's right. thedirtbag@kboo.org. And the first person that writes in with the correct answer will get a free garden hand tool sharpening from Coley Farm Store in Northeast Portland, here on Northeast 42nd and Alberta Street. This is, pruners, loppers, shears, shovels, hoes. So thedirtbag@kbo.org.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, and it's going to be fun to get emails from folks too. So please be sure to write. So this is pretty simple, I think. I've traveled quite a bit to New Zealand, and I really enjoy the country. I discovered it. I think 2017 was my first trip there. And one of the fruits that I discovered there, I was impressed with the work that the New Zealanders had done, was one that the more common international name is feijoa, oftentimes called in America pineapple guava, but it is neither a pineapple nor a guava. It's a plant that's native to Brazil. Well, how in Brazil, the climate is not so great for this particular plant, and there's a lot of more pests and diseases and stuff, so the New Zealanders actually had a much better time with it, and it grows great here too, and I'll have time to talk a little bit more about that later. But the main thing was that the New Zealanders took a fruit from somewhere else and made it into a much better fruit, and their varieties are the best, as far as I'm concerned, the best in the world, and they do export them to internationally, and they built an industry on this fruit. Well, there's another fruit that had the same kind of history. Its native country was growing it without doing much with it, kind of no big deal, and the New Zealanders saw promise there, and they made it into a very, very popular fruit as well. And the garden stumper is, what fruit is it, and where is it native to?
Hmm. Okay. Well, it's too bad we don't have the phones to go to right now, because I'm sure we would get a lot of guesses on that.
Yeah.
But you can write to us at thedirtbag@kboo.org. And the first person with the correct answer will get that free garden tool sharpening from Gully Farm Store. All right. We'll go to one more topic here, and then we will go for our second musical break. But first of all, let's see. Let's talk about winterizing tools. You know, I'm sure, you know, we all take pretty good care of our tools. I mean, we don't want to leave shovels outside and things like that. But if you do happen to do that, there are ways that you can, use linseed oil or something on the wood handle or something like that, sand it down, reapply the oil and whatnot. But I think it'd be better just not to leave it outside in the rain in the first place. Of course, it happens to everybody, but you can oil up things, which is nice. You can sharpen blades when you have the downtime in the winter. Jim, do you do anything special with your tools?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, pretty much what you're saying, Glenn. Put them away. We have a fair number of tools out here at the nursery, and they're all, as far as I know, inside.
Yeah.
I hope. I think you learn in life that taking care of your tools is just so darn important. I mean, there's nothing, when you're trying to do a job and you don't have the proper tool for it, or it's dull or it's broken or something, it's pretty frustrating, and you can lose a lot of time trying to deal with that. So what they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly the case with tools. So, they get oiled when they need it and sharpened when they need it. And best we can do. I mean, there's always something that you might have to go get something new. But
yeah.
And I, these, of course, it's kind of nice. You know, some of the tools these days have, I have a wood splitter, a splitting maul that has a fiberglass handle on it. And I like that. I mean, I liked wood. But if I miss trying to split some firewood or something, it doesn't just shatter. It's a pretty darn strong handle. So I'm kind of a believer in that.
You're still out there splitting wood?
I do it, not as much as I used to, but I have somebody else. Much because of my eyesight, it's a little more difficult in some cases. But you know, I've got some beautiful firewood this year, Glenn. Oak that came down in that ice storm we had about 4 years ago. It's like coal. Oh gosh, it makes a wonderful it's fire.
Quite cured by now.
Very cured. Yep.
Right. All right. Well, let's get to our second musical break. This is from Sonny Boy Williamson. Going back a little ways there. This is called Bye Bye Bird. Sonny Boy Williamson, Bye Bye Bird, Hello Thanksgiving. No, that's not part of the tag. All right. This is Glenn Andreessen here, the Dirtbag, along with Jim Gilbert and our ace engineer, Joe Wilson of Bergman Productions, making this all happen, and we appreciate that. We'll talk next about curing olives. I know we talked a lot about olives last month because that's why you went to Italy, or that was one of the reasons why you went to Italy in the last few months anyway. But now we'll talk about curing them.
Well, it's funny, Glenn, I was talking with Lorraine this morning about how some fruits and plants become more interesting to me and others become slightly less interesting over the years I've been doing this work. And right now, olives are up pretty high on my list. And one of the interesting things about olives, there are folks in Oregon right now, and some of them may be listening, and I really appreciate their interest in this, are working on growing olives to make olive oil. And that's a very worthy goal. However, for a homeowner, it's probably you're not going to get a lot of olive oil off of a couple of olive trees, you know, maybe a pint or something like that. And I don't know how you'd have to find a way to mill it and all that. So our focus here at Northwoods Nursery are olive varieties for the table. And I've noticed over many years too that if you buy like pizza from a low quality or inexpensive place that has olives on it, the olives don't really have much taste, if any at all. I mean, they look like olives. They're black, but the way they make them that way is a like kind of an industrial process almost, and it takes all the stuff out of them, and you can't eat a raw olive in most cases. They're really tart and almost with some bitterness in them, so but olives have an amazing history many centuries, thousands of years of growing, people have grown olives and learned how to work with them. And they are a very, very important part of the diet in countries like Italy and Spain and Portugal and other ones. So here we are in Oregon. And Oregon has, no history of olive growing. And it was not part of the Native Americans' diet. But we have olive trees here. And over the years, we here at Northwoods, we were able to bring some really interesting varieties here. And a group of varieties in particular that we brought were from Crimea. And the capital of Crimea is Yalta, and next on the Mediterranean. And they had Greeks living there many, many years ago that had brought olives there. And then they had their own collection. And they basically were sort of doing breeding work for cold hardiness and early ripening. And to grow olives here in our climate, they need to ripen fairly early. There are a lot of older varieties that will ripen late, but that won't work for us. So this year we had arguably the biggest crop of olives that I have seen. And we just finished brining about 16 quarts of olives.
Hmm.
Really fun. So we've also learned some things, and we have a book with some recipes for the brine. But the basic process is that you take these ripe olives, and determining ripeness, generally we just wait till around the 1st of November, or late October, and they're ripe. We have some that actually are ripening earlier than that. And some of those are hopefully going to be out on the market soon too. But the Crimean ones are pretty good. They get ripe. They ripen relatively early. And so we harvest the olives. We pick the olives. We wash them and put them in fill a quart jar with the olives. And then we make the brine. And there's a recipe, which in this case, we're using a recipe that makes you make a salt solution and then add vinegar to it. And you fill the jar with that solution. What we do then is we take some rosemary, or you can use other herbs, and make a little mat on the top of the olives. So you kind of, when you put the lid on the jar, it sort of pushes them down so they're underneath the solution. And then right now those 16 quarts are in the refrigerator, where they will probably be for probably 6 months or so before that salts and vinegar solution extracts the bitterness from the olive. And again, if you compare the flavor of home cured olives like that to what you can typically buy in the store, it would be probably something like maybe a Red Delicious apple versus in my case a Wine Crisp or something. They're just hard to describe how good they are and how enjoyable it is to eat a really well cured, home cured olive.
You might have to bring some to the studio here in the next few months.
I might have to do that.
Yeah,
that's right.
I don't think I've ever had a home cured olive.
Well, what I was hoping is that since this, any listeners out there who happen to have olives on a plant that they would like to cure. My request is that you email us at kboo.org, and I will send you the recipe.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
And you can try that recipe, and we have other ones that we're experimenting with as well. But the one we have a good friend in southern Italy who gave us this recipe, and it's we really like it. Really works well for us. So
does the rosemary dunk, if you will, impart any flavor to that jar of olives?
Well, maybe a little bit. It certainly adds an aroma to the jar, and so you probably couldn't help think that there's probably a little bit of flavor too with that. It's a pretty fun thing to do, and like I said, growing olives for table use for a homeowner is probably a lot more practical than growing olives for oil. Oil and typical varieties that people use for oil are quite small. like Arbequina is a variety that we grew here for a long time, but it's a very small olive. The nice thing about these ones that we have from Crimea and our other accessions are they're good size. They're very nice sized fruit. So, you know, I'm pretty bullish right now on olives, just adding to my list.
Well, I'm curious as to if you could give us an example of a plant that you've lost, that has lost a little bit of favor with you.
Well, that's a good one. So what are the interesting differences between olives? Well, first, I also want to mention that olives is a nice, attractive plant because it's an evergreen shrub. So it keeps its leaves all year. I wouldn't say I've lost interest in them, but I'm not as passionately doing as much work with them. Like Seaberry would be one of those. Which I really like, but Lorraine and I were talking about this last night about the fact that because of all this crap that's gone on with Russia, we can't go there, and that was our source for information and varieties and all the cultural stuff about Seaberry, which is where it's probably arguably there and former East Germany was the two places where it was most developed. Germany we could go to, but not Russia's huge, and there's lots of varieties, and they have some that have really interesting characteristics, but we can't go there. So it's kind of lost a little bit of my fire with that particular plant, and Feijoa is another one that I've gotten real excited about too recently. So
well, it's fine, you know, you explore something and then you go on and explore something else, so it's perfectly understandable.
Yeah, we don't really tolerate boredom out here Northwoods. So
no,
there's not a shred of it with all these fun plants.
Right. Okay. Well, along the same topic here, or another topic here, is dividing rhubarb, and I grow a lot of rhubarb. It's a plant that, like persimmon, just doesn't seem to have any problems with pests. It does require water, which isn't necessarily a bad thing either. One of the things that you can imagine, these huge leaves of rhubarb, and they're shaped that if we're getting a rainfall, that it just funnels that water right into the crown of the plant. So just a hint that these plants do require water. But there comes a time when a rhubarb just doesn't seem to be putting out as big of stalks and leaves as it used to, and that's a sure sign that it needs that it's time to be divided. And this is the same with other plants that are similar to rhubarb, like irises or something like that. Not edible, but it's time for them to be divided. And with rhubarb, it's quite easy, at least how I do it, and that is you can dig up the whole thing. And believe me, this will take sometimes some doing. You want to make sure that you have a strong shovel, because if you put the tines in from a very weak shovel, it's likely that you'll just bend the cheap metal, because they can really they're big plants and they stick into the ground a lot. Wait till it's dormant, like now, and the ground is moist, and so dig up the whole thing. And you don't really need to be that careful either, because you're always going to have an eye, or it's where the growing part of the plant, and you might even divide it four ways. And sometimes how I divide it is if nothing else, you could just take an axe and just split it, whack it. Or if you have two shovels, turn the shovels, you know, back to back. And so you have kind of a digging point and just jab it in there to just to divide it. That's what we're trying to do. And so once you divide it in half, then you can divide each of those halves also in half, and you'll end up with four. That's why you end up with a lot of rhubarb. If you start with one, you know, you'll have a lot more. And you know, for me, part of it is I just don't want to let these, you know, let three quarters of this plant die. But it's better to do that than to not divide it at all, because it'll just continue to have diminishing returns. So just replant a quarter of it in that same plant place if you'd like, and give away the others, or let it just compost it. Easy, and it should be done, you know, probably every 4 to 5 years.
And when's the best time to do that, Glenn?
Well, when it's dormant, now is fine. Mm-hmm. And if you replant now, you know, it's still kind of warm soil, and so the roots will start growing. Same reason that we've talked about. It's a good time to plant potted plants now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what do you like to do with rhubarb?
I make sauce out of it. We freeze it whole chunks and then use it to make crisps in the winter. Back in the day, as you know, I've now retired from my food booth at the Scandinavian Festival, but for about 5 or so years, we used to make a rhubarb drink, which was very good. And rhubarb is kind of one of those plants where you either love it or you hate it. And I'm in the former. I love it. And the drink was made, you know, with some sugar, of course, and also orange juice. But it was a very creamy, thick and cream, well, not thick, but creamy juice. And you boil it, and then we followed this recipe. And it was a lot of work, and some people really liked it. But I think it was too much work, and there wasn't enough people that it was worth our while to continue to do it. So I think we did it for 4 or 5 years or something like that. But
I've heard of, you know, rhubarb pie. I haven't had any for a long time, but I remember it was a really very tasty and delicious dessert.
Yeah. I particularly like the combination of rhubarb and strawberry. And so yes. I'll make just a sauce, rhubarb sauce, and then add sliced strawberries just to have it for breakfast or some other meal, just as a fruit. So
sounds great.
Yeah,
that sounds really good.
Okay, let's see. We're approaching the end here. Jim, did you want to say something on another plant there?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk a bit about feijoa.
Okay.
Pineapple guava, because that's also ripe now. It's kind of interesting. Olives, persimmon, and feijoa are sort of our latest ripening fruits here. And we have an amazing crop of feijoa. I think I might mention earlier that our office is full of them right now as we are sampling different ones from seedlings to see if we can find something that's better than what we already have. But I would imagine there are some listeners out there that have feijoa plants, and they're a beautiful evergreen shrub. They're a plant that I believe needs to be more widely planted all over the world. New Zealand is where it's, as I said earlier, they're native to Brazil, but New Zealand has done the work with them. And if you go to New Zealand in their fall, which is our spring, you will find feijoa fruit everywhere. I mean, it's just like so popular. Everybody eats it. And my grandkids were out here a week and a half ago, and they just devoured them. I mean, so a feijoa typically has a tart skin and a sweet interior, and it's a really very tasty fruit, I believe, and about the size of a small pear, maybe the bigger ones. And you can cut them right in half and just sort of scoop out the inside. Mm-hmm. Or you can cut them lengthways like you might do a watermelon and eat them like with a, like quarters, just and don't eat the skin. One of my criteria in our breeding work is edible skin. So and I eat the whole thing. Just take a bite of them and just eat the whole darn fruit. Mm-hmm. Right, really, really delicious. But it's late ripening. So what you want to do is find early ripening varieties. And we have these ones from New Zealand that are really great. Some of the names are like Kakariki, Kaitiri, Anatoki, Takaka, Wainaro. Those are all, I think, native names from that region. And then one called Marion and Ramsey are another couple of ones that we've been getting going recently, because these are all varieties that are superior to ones that were around 20 or 30 years ago. So we're pretty excited about them. But the again, like I said, the early ripening is the important part with that. And they make, also besides eating fresh, they make wonderful preserves. And I just know pest or disease problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pretty hard to beat, you know.
Yeah. Are these three things that we're talking about here, are they the last things that are going to ripen?
Pretty much. I can't think of anything. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, but I can't think of anything else out there that hasn't ripened yet.
All right.
I mean, there's fruit that let's see, spring ripening fruit.
Well, yeah.
But not, I think at this time, I mean, of course, things like hazelnuts and stuff, I mean, they bloom late, but they're already finished too. And maybe some nuts might still be around, but
yeah,
we're pretty much at the end of the season.
Well, it's November.
That's right. Yeah, I know. And it's getting toward the holidays and all the fun stuff that gets to go and you get to make and eat then. So,
yep. Okay, well, one last thing is, before we get to the end of our time here, our dirtbag dictionary term is cold frame. Like I said, I don't think we've talked about this before, but it's just a very simple way that you can extend your season on both ends. And it's just essentially a frame of wood, and it can have a pane of glass or something that just fits over the soil. And you can plant things in the cold frame if there's no bottom in the cold frame, just right into the soil. Or you can put pots in there and whatnot, depending on how tall your cold frame is. And you can get another 3 or 4 weeks in very cold weather. You know, here we are talking in the second week of November, and I don't think we've had a killing frost here. I'm just going to briefly check my weather station, the history, excuse me, and to see the coldest that it's been. Yeah, this month is 42.4. Jim, you've probably been below 40, certainly, eh?
We had 31.
Oh, here.
Yeah, it's been out here in the liberal nook. But
okay.
Yeah, I know you
guys. Anything else? Go ahead, Jim.
Well, the other thing I was going to say was, I know we've mentioned this pretty much every show, but the documentary film, anybody that hasn't heard me say, you go to it's called, of course, An Oregon Story, Saving Our Beaches, Farmland, and More. And anoregonstory.com. is where you can find links to the film, and we're now, the classroom version is almost finished.
Oh, good.
So we're that'll be the next big thing. So.
Great. Okay. Well, I think we're out of time. Yes, Joe. Yep, we're right about there. Our last tune from the birds theme comes from Robin Ford. Hey, how about that? I hadn't even thought about that. Robin, R-O-B-B-E-N, but. Robin Ford is the artist. It is called Bird's Nest Bound, and it's from Bringing It Back Home CD. All right. Jim, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Glenn.
Glad we could do it. Joe, we really appreciate you and Bergman Productions for making this technology all happen. This is Glenn Andreessen. Thanks for listening. Be well.
Build me a bird's nest right in the heart of your tent. I'm gonna build me a bird's nest right in the heart of your tent.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Jazz Lives, right after these news headlines.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.